Welcome to Fertility Friendly Food, the podcast. My name is Stephanie Vlahakis and I'm an expert certified fertility dietitian and nutritionist and founder of The Dietologist, a multiple award-winning virtual fertility and pregnancy nutrition clinic serving thousands from around the world and, of course, the host of this pod, Fertility Friendly Food. This podcast is dedicated to all things health and nutrition in the world of fertility, reproductive health, and pregnancy. Each week, I bring you practical snack-sized episodes to help improve your lifestyle on your trying-to-conceive journey, alongside guest expert interviews to help inspire you to learn and grow whilst you grow your family. This episode is brought to you by our Nourishing Gut Health for Endometriosis Masterclass, which I will be delivering to you live on March 23rd at 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Saving Time, which is Sydney or Melbourne time. Yes, that is today, the day of release of this podcast. So come and join me to learn the relationship between endometriosis and gut health, including the gut microbiome from the latest research, understand how to tackle common and bothersome gut concerns and endo, including bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and nausea, with super practical tips that you can take away and implement to have a happier tum. Tickets are still on sale now, but do not sleep on this. They are going quickly and we will be going live tonight. You will get 90 days access to the recording to rewatch it again and again. Plus, of course, access the bonus downloadable workbook, which summarizes all the key points and practical elements so that you don't have to take as many notes. Tickets are just $75 Australian and $10 will be donated to the Pelvic Pain Foundation of Australia, who raise awareness for pelvic pain conditions like endometriosis amongst adolescents to reduce the time to diagnosis as part of Endometriosis Awareness Month. So on to today's episode, which is one that I am excited to be bringing to you. We are going to be talking about SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, a condition that is certainly under-researched and thus is definitely under a mysterious cloud when it comes to understanding it, its causes, and the management and treatment. This episode is part of our endometriosis mini-series for Endometriosis Awareness Month in March. We have one more to go after this. Can't wait for you to tune into the last one. I see a lot of chit-chat about SIBO and endometriosis in the online space, particularly Instagram, but every time I go and look at the scientific literature about it, I feel there is very little or none to be found. It could just be that science is likely playing a bit of catch-up, which does leave those who are suffering with symptoms of significant and painful bloating that won't go away despite best efforts with diet and medications in the dark. So I have invited my colleague and IBS dietitian, Crystal Austin, APD, onto the podcast today to answer your questions about SIBO. So let's get into it. So welcome, Crystal, to the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, Steph, thank you so much for having me. I'm actually really excited to talk about this topic.
Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it? So before we get into today's topic of SIBO and endometriosis, tell us a bit about who you are, what you do, so our listeners can get to know you a little bit more.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Crystal and I'm a dietitian that specializes specifically around irritable bowel syndrome or IBS and other gut conditions. So people that are struggling with things like bloating, constipation, diarrhea. My whole practice is around helping those people to feel better, improve their relationship with their body and with food, and really just finding their freedom and getting their life back.
Incredible work that you do, and absolutely love your Instagram content. It's always on fleek. So if you don't, go follow Crystal. It's at IBS FODMAP Dietitian. I'll have it linked in the show notes, but definitely go give her a follow because she gives so much incredibly valuable content away for free. So worth a follow. So today's episode is all about SIBO and endometriosis. And I am the first one to say that I am no expert in SIBO management. And it is quite a tricky diagnosis and condition from my understanding, despite the name making it sound super simple of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So let's unpack it a bit more. What is SIBO?
So it's exactly like you mentioned. The name is a little bit self-explanatory when you break it down. So small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Basically what it is, it's this bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine. So for those that aren't that familiar with the gut microbiome, we have trillions of microorganisms and bacteria living in our large intestine. Here, they do lots of amazing things and we want them in that large intestine. But we're not supposed to have large amounts in the small intestine. And some of the things we'll talk about today of why this happens, but basically the bacteria can overgrow or migrate up into the small intestine where it's not really supposed to be and results in all sorts of uncomfortable gut symptoms and problems for people.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's touch on a little bit about what some of the likely causes of SIBO are. Because I know with IBS, there's no precise known cause. There's some potential theories and potential triggers. But is that the same case with SIBO, or is there some kind of events that precipitate getting SIBO?
Yeah, so quite similar with IBS. You know, we're learning a lot more about SIBO as time goes on and as more research comes out. So there's theories and there's ideas and there's correlations that we're seeing alongside other, not just gut conditions, actually alongside other medical conditions, including we see it a lot alongside IBS, celiac disease, Crohn's disease, diabetes, gastric bypass surgery is another big one. So people that have had sort of weight loss surgeries, there's a big correlation there. A lot of that is thought to do with motility. So motility being how fast or slow things move through the body. And a lot of these conditions actually slow down motility. So if things aren't moving through the gut, then this overgrowth can occur. So if you think about a stream, like a water stream, and with the stream, the water's all moving through quite quickly. But if the stream slows down, algae can start to overgrow. You know, you get all of that algae and all sorts of things, slime growing. The body's quite similar. So if things aren't moving through quick enough, then this bacteria can overgrow in different areas and it's not kind of swept out properly. We see slower motility in conditions like constipation, hypothyroidism, you know, IBS, all of those. So that's the correlation we're seeing there, one of the reasons between these conditions. Other places is low gastric acid. So if someone has been on long-term PPI use, that's stopping them from secreting lots of gastric acid. There's some correlations happening there because one of the roles of the acid in the stomach is actually to kill off bacteria. So if there's levels of acid, it makes sense that potentially this bacteria is overgrowing. The other one that we've seen more of as well is food poisoning. So if you are someone who's had a bad bout of food poisoning or you've gone traveling and gotten sick and then you've ended up with post-infectious IBS, you know, there's this question mark around how much is actually IBS and how much is a bacterial change or bacterial overgrowth. So there's some of the key causes or correlations that I would say we're seeing with development of SIBO.
Fascinating. So interesting how there's so much crossover. When you were talking about the motility piece, I instantly thought of constipation and hypothyroidism, like you said, which are conditions which many people who also have endometriosis also experience, just because residual, I guess, prevalence in a female dominant group, but also, you know, as an increased risk association with endometriosis itself. So perhaps that might potentially explain some of that crossover as well.
Definitely. And I didn't mention endometriosis in there, but there's definitely a crossover with endometriosis. And we know there's the crossover with endometriosis and IBS as well. So there's a whole mix happening there.
It's like one big messy Venn diagram, isn't it? When you look at all the crossovers.
Yeah, definitely.
What are some of the key symptoms of SIBO? Somebody might be listening to this and going, oh, gosh, some of this sounds like it might be relevant to me, but what does this actually look like?
The tricky thing with SIBO is that a lot of the symptoms are really similar to IBS and other gut conditions. So the key symptoms that we see crossover are things like bloating, abdominal pain or cramping, excessive gas, constipation and diarrhea, which anyone with IBS will know, you know, these are the symptoms that we often see there. So huge crossover there. Personally, in practice of how I usually view SIBO is the bloating is a really big piece. So having this chronic bloating that's not responding to our treatment. So maybe it's we fix the constipation, but the bloating continues, or you've gone through the low FODMAP diet and the bloating continues. One of the things bacteria does is it eats the food that we eat and breaks that down and produces gas. So if you've got this bacterial overgrowth, there's excess gas being produced, it's in the small intestine, it's, you know, you're holding onto all this gas, then causing more bloating. So thinking about those IBS symptoms is usually the symptoms that we're seeing coming up.
Got you. It's fascinating because, again, like thinking about the endometriosis population, having endo myself, you know, I felt that when I had my endometriosis excision surgery, I had a formal diagnosis of IBS prior to that. After my excision, my IBS symptoms completely dissipated, and so too did my FODMAP intolerances, which made me think it was probably a bit of a misdiagnosis in my situation because it's just eradicated. But for those that have residual symptoms or are not finding benefit from the low FODMAP diet or other strategies targeting IBS or gut symptoms, it's kind of like almost like a diagnosis of exclusion, right? Like you're working through all the potential strategies and treatments for other diagnoses or other potential causes. And then you get to the end and like, actually, this is still going on. I think the additional layer of trickiness for people who are listening who do have endometriosis is endometriosis itself can cause the distension and the bloating, and bowel endometriosis can contribute to diarrhea and constipation, all these other symptoms. So it becomes incredibly difficult when people pose a question to me as a clinician, and probably to you as a clinician too, of like, well, how do I know if it's SIBO, it's endo, or it's IBS? And sometimes we don't know because there's no quick test for each of those things to isolate them out, which does make it challenging, which does lead me to my next question, which is, how do you know you have SIBO? How do you get a diagnosis? Is there a test? There are multiple tests. And how do we access those kinds of tests? Like, is it with your doctor or privately?
Yeah, really good question. And I think what you said there is really, really important with all of these medical conditions is we don't always know. So we're doing this investigative process. And personally, how I work with my clients is I do work with them through programs. So I'm working with them for 4 to 6 months at least. And we're going through these steps together because a lot of the time it's really hard to access services because you're out there on your own, you know, experiencing these symptoms and like, well, what do I do now? Where do I turn next? Like, my doctor's not very helpful. Like, what do I do now? So having someone there to support you through these investigative processes can be really, really beneficial. In terms of testing for SIBO, so one thing I should say with SIBO is that it's not a newer medical condition. It's been around for a long time, but the research has not been very strong or reliable. And so we're really only learning more about it as each year comes on, and we're getting better quality research as time goes on. But there is still some really huge gaps in that research, and what we know for there's gaps in testing accuracy, there's gaps in treatment, and there's also gaps in knowledge for the medical community. So there are some doctors that still won't accept that SIBO is a real condition, and that's one of the biggest barriers when it comes to this topic. In terms of testing, the most accessible test is a breath test. So there is a specific breath test for SIBO. For this breath test, you'll drink a carbohydrate substrate or solution. So in the lead up to the test, you go on like a low carb diet and a really bland diet, and then you do some fasting, and then you do this test where you drink this carbohydrate solution and then blow out into a breath test afterwards. And what that's measuring is the different gases that are produced and the timing of these gases. These then give us information on if you have a bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine, which then helps to, you know, diagnose potentially SIBO. The issue with these testing is that for these tests, when we're looking at sensitivity, for these tests to show a true positive rate, it's between 40 and 50% accuracy. So it's quite low. So that's saying that if this test came back positive, 40 to 50% of the time it actually is positive, but, you know, potentially it's actually negative as well. Similar with if you do the test and it's showing a true negative, this is between sort of 70 to 80%, which again is quite low. We usually have these numbers over 90%. So what I'm saying there is there are breath tests that can help to lead this diagnosis, but there is inaccuracies in there. So if you have symptoms, your test comes back negative, but something is still missing, you can still pursue treatment and pursue help, and vice versa as well. Just because you get a negative test doesn't mean you can't still pursue treatment. That also brings us to treatment. Some doctors won't do these tests at all because of that inaccuracy. At the moment, they're the best things, most accessible thing that we have, so they can be really helpful. It'll just really come down to your medical team if you do the breath test or not. The other tricky thing with breath tests is that they are usually on a private script. So I know here in Australia, I can order clients' tests to their home, and then we take those results to their doctor or gastroenterologist for treatment. the tests in Australia vary between sort of $200 to $400 each. So when we take into account that cost, the cost that the treatment is, which can be anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars, there's also a couple of barriers in there. So the breath test is basically one option. It does lead treatment. It can be helpful, but it's not always necessary depending on your medical team.
Got you. In your experience clinically, how often are you suspecting that maybe there's some SIBO, but then due to the barriers and the inaccuracies, you're kind of maybe making a clinical judgment that it could be SIBO and just progressing into treatment to give it a go anyway, because you're kind of at the end of the line of other treatment strategies. Is that a consideration?
Yeah, definitely. And I think personally, I work, 100% of my clients have irritable bowel syndrome. So I'm seeing a lot of IBS clients and I'm seeing a lot of complex clients because people come to me after having this for a long time. So in my practice, I would say we go down that SIBO route maybe 30% of the time. So 70% of the time, my clients respond really well to first line strategies and we really get their symptoms under control quite quickly. And then there's 30% of the population that are more complex and symptoms don't resolve or there's other things happening that make me suspicious of going down this route. And then whether we get the test or not, I'll ask them if what their preference is, usually based on finances and based on timing and based on the medical team. So lately, I've been more kind of directed to say, let's go see your gastroenterologist, talk about it and talk about the treatment, because I think whether that test comes back negative or positive, it's probably worth trialing the treatment anyway. So sometimes it's a bit of a barrier if that test comes back negative and then they're like, what do we do now? I'm like, I actually think it's still worth trialing the treatment because that gives us a bit of indication anyway if you actually have the SIBO.
Yeah, I hear such a similarity in the endometriosis space in exactly this. So the same thing with the false negatives and false positives and treatment anyway, which is the deep infiltrating endometriosis scans. So deep infiltrating endometriosis ultrasound scans are an internal, more comprehensive ultrasound that's done by an expert sonographer. And the idea is it can potentially detect more advanced stages of endometriosis, like stage 3 and stage 4, or large endometriosis cysts or endometriomas, or if there's adhesions and the organs are starting to stick together, then we'll see it. But just because that's negative, as in that's clear, that ultrasound is negative, doesn't mean you don't have endometriosis and it's not worth doing a laparoscopy. But what happens is, and I've fell victim to this myself, is you can almost like gaslight yourself into not pursuing more treatment because, oh, well, the test was negative. And so you have to factor that in when you do those tests as to like, how much is this really going to change your decision-making about your next steps? And if it's not, then is it worth the expense and inconvenience of the test? Sometimes maybe not.
Yeah, definitely, particularly when it's going to influence that next decision. The only other thing I would say with the test, that the benefit of doing the test is if it does come back positive, we see what gases are higher. So there's different types of gases that'll show up on a test, being hydrogen and methane being the predominant ones. And what we're also seeing in the research and in how people respond to the treatment options is there's different treatment options for the different gases. So the benefit of doing the test is that we'll see, okay, you have higher levels of methane or higher levels of hydrogen, and that means this type of treatment is going to be better. So that is definitely a benefit of doing that as well if it does come back positive. But again, usually this communication happens with the client and with their medical team of what the best option is going to be, because this is a little bit out of scope as a dietitian. So I'm there really supporting these conversations with the gastroenterologist.
Yeah, I hear you. The amount of conversations and advocacy that we do that isn't precisely in our scope, but somebody has to do it.
Yeah.
Happens all the time. What are the key management strategies from a dietetic perspective that you would typically use? So say somebody's, you know, either confirmed it with the gas test or they've decided, you know, to proceed with the treatment strategy. What's kind of the next step, maybe top line? Because obviously I know even things like low FODMAP diet, to explain it in adequate detail takes like an hour. So I'm not sure if it's as complex as SIBO, but yeah, give me, I guess, a bit of a overview.
So I think the key point here is that diet will not treat SIBO. And this is a really huge thing that some other practitioners out there are promoting, specific diets that are really, really restrictive and hard to do to treat your SIBO. At this stage, the research does not support a specific diet will treat SIBO. However, where the role of the dietitian comes in is really supporting you symptom management, replenishing any deficiencies, and supporting that treatment and preventing relapse of the SIBO. So to treat that bacterial overgrowth, we can't starve it out or can't, you know, with different aspects of the diet, which a lot of these other diets promote, that they can sort of, if you cut all carbs, it'll starve off the bacteria, but it doesn't happen. So instead, we do need that level of treatment, which is typically a specific type of antibiotic to actually eliminate or eradicate or reduce that bacterial overgrowth first and foremost. To support that, we can support symptom management. So in practice, I do use the low FODMAP diet if appropriate for clients, because what that does is helps them to at least reduce their symptoms while we're going through this process and take that edge off. However, I also allow flexibility in that. So if following the low FODMAP diet is too hard for them, it's impacting their social life, or if they have a poor relationship with food, you know, we're not going to go down that pathway. We're going to allow liberalization. When we're talking about things like motility, that's, you know, a dietitian has a huge role in supporting your motility or preventing constipation, because if you have slow motility or if you struggle with constipation, that needs to be at the forefront all of the time, because if your bowels are not moving and clearing, it's going to be hard to treat the SIBO. It's also going to regrow pretty quickly. So keeping your bowels moving and supporting that, you know, we know diet plays a huge role in constipation. In really severe cases of SIBO, it can end up similar to celiac disease, in that there is damage to the actual villi in the small intestine, and there can be then deficiencies in your enzymes and carbohydrate malabsorption. So you might find you are more sensitive to foods like lactose in cases of SIBO. So we'll be managing food intolerances while you go through that healing process. There's also, if we're talking about your meal spacing, so I always am helping my clients to eat regularly and have gaps between their meals, because one of the things with SIBO is that we have this something called our migrating motor complex, which is kind of like a clean sweeper. It comes through the gut and it clears everything out, which if we're clearing everything out is really important to stop bacterial overgrowth again. So, you know, it helps to do that. But if you're constantly grazing or picking throughout the day, your migrating motor complex doesn't work. It doesn't do its job. So then it's more likely to get a bacterial overgrowth, either develop one or relapse. So, you know, a dietitian can definitely support you in looking at regular eating, making nourishing meals, helping you feel satisfied and to support that kind of relapse issue as well.
I'm so glad you mentioned those starve it out style of diets and how there's no evidence to support that, because I can't tell you how often I've seen that kind of rhetoric popularized on Instagram and influencers doing these crazy restrictive diet. And all I can think of is, A, how many people could be triggered into an eating disorder and acquire an intense fear of carbohydrate containing foods, which FYI is a lot of food. And B, the other component is what kind of dysbiosis are we going to get in the large intestine with the gut microbiome, because the gut microbiome is thriving off fermentable fibers, and the long-term consequences of that, if it's not a short-term thing and there's those residual food fears. And I used to see it in keto. I don't know if keto is as popular as it used to be 5 years ago, but when I started practicing, keto was peaking, and every single person that I kind of like de-ketoed would have these long-standing gut issues because they were just deprived of fiber and plant material for so long. Those populations just died off, and so then there was nothing there to digest it. And so you can almost cause a different problem if you go down that rabbit hole. And even if it feels temporarily better, you may cause a longer term consequence. Is that accurate summary?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with both of those points, particularly around disordered eating, poor relationship with food and eating disorders, both ways. So gut issues are extremely common amongst eating disorders. So if you're someone that has struggled with an eating disorder and you're on that, you know, pathway to healing and improving everything, and you're struggling with gut symptoms, you might automatically think that you do need to go down a restrictive diet, and this is what you've seen online as the solution for gut issues, but it's not the case and it's not recommended. So please know that there's other treatment options, and you need time for your body to heal after that eating disorder, and going down a restrictive diet is not the solution for that. Vice versa, with gut issues, we see a huge amount of disordered eating coming out of that, because of these restrictive diets and because of a lot of the things that people try, because which I no judgment because I completely understand it. As someone who does have IBS, I understand the desire to feel better and the desperation that comes with that. And you think you're doing the right thing because that's all we see, like cut out gluten, cut out carbs, whatever it might be. But you don't need to go down that pathway and just be really wary of anyone promoting these really significant restrictive diets. And anyone that's not screening you for just for an eating disorder first, like that needs to be forefront. If you are a dietitian listening, please don't put people on restrictive diets unless you've screened them for eating disorders, because there's this huge kind of crossover here.
Yeah, please, 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 triple please, because sometimes, yeah, I've seen negative consequences for sure for a variety of different types of diets and presentations for disordered eating and eating disorders. Okay, my next question is about medical management. You briefly touched on antibiotics. Is that kind of the extent of what can be done? And I guess, can perhaps you give us a little bit more context? Because I have a feeling perhaps some of my listeners may be thinking, hang on, gut health, antibiotics equals bad for gut health. How is this going to help me? So perhaps you could give it some more, yeah, color, I guess.
Yeah, of course. And again, completely understand where that comes from. Some people's gut issues come after antibiotics. There's also a lot of fear about antibiotics, and we don't want to be taking antibiotics unnecessarily. However, in some conditions, you know, they are necessary and they can play a role in overall management of medical conditions. So when it comes to treatment, medical management of SIBO, we're looking at a couple of main goals. Number one is to induce remission from this. So we're reducing or eradicating that bacterial overgrowth. That's at the key. Number two is treating the underlying cause or preventing it from growing back. So, you know, sometimes we can see, okay, you know, you very clearly have constipation. That's probably where this is coming from. We treat the constipation to prevent relapse. Other times, if it's something like food poisoning, you know, it's a bit easier to treat that. So preventing food poisoning. So treating the underlying reason it's happening and then actually treating the bacterial overgrowth. As we mentioned, diet won't treat the bacterial overgrowth, but we do have evidence for a couple of specific antibiotics that do this. One really common one is called rifaximin or Xifaxan. That treatment usually goes for 14 days. You're taking it 3 times per day. The thing with rifaximin is that it's not as absorbed, or it's not absorbable into the gut like other antibiotics. So it's considered more safe to use and less likely to cause issues. So first and foremost, you know, it is a better antibiotic that can be used, and it's shown to be the most effective. There is some practitioners out there that will use herbal remedies. And just at this stage, as a dietitian, as Steph would practice this as well, you know, we practice based on evidence-based research, and which means that we, you know, what has been studied, shown to be effective, shown to be safe, that's what we're going to follow because we know that works and we know that's the safest route. At this stage, that's, you know, antibiotics is what we know ticks those boxes. Hopefully in the future with more research, we're going to get more treatment options that's going to cover different bases and it's going to get easier to treat. There are some herbal remedies that, yeah, different practitioners do use, but at this stage they're not evidence-based. So I'm looking forward to see research in this area to see other options as well for people that don't want to go down the antibiotic route.
Yeah, fascinating. I have a bit of a tack-on question to the antibiotic conversation, which is typically a lot of co-treatment with antibiotics traditionally tends to be probiotics, either whilst you're taking the antibiotic or for a period of time afterwards to try to mitigate some of the, I guess, the obliteration of the gut microbiota populations in the large intestine. Are probiotics something that you would utilize alongside this treatment, or is that something that you wouldn't advise because then you're introducing more live bacteria via the gut? And potentially because of the issues with the motility, if that's not been resolved, then it might get stuck, so to speak, in the small intestine.
Yeah, so the question is there evidence for, or do we use probiotics alongside SIBO treatment and alongside that antibiotic treatment? And as far as I know at this stage in the research, no, probiotics are not used alongside that. There has been some studies that have shown that using probiotics post-antibiotic treatment in other scenarios actually is worse for repopulation of the gut. So probiotics, again, are not this thing that just because they're a probiotic doesn't mean they're safe, doesn't mean they're effective, doesn't mean you should be using it. my theory or my assumption is similar to what you just mentioned, Steph, is that, you know, it's a bacterial overgrowth. So adding more bacteria in there, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what bacteria is actually overgrown. So how do we know what to add in there? And is that going to cause more harm? One, going back to symptoms of IBS or sometimes a red flag, is if someone is taking probiotics and responding negatively, sometimes to me that kind of points me towards this SIBO direction or adds to the case of, you know, they're responding negative, they're getting symptoms from taking probiotics, like is there a bacterial overgrowth happening? So in short, no. I personally don't use them in practice for SIBO. But again, if research changes in the future, then I'm always more really open to seeing.
Yeah, you read my mind, because I've definitely had a few client scenarios where we've kind of gotten to the end of the IBS process in managing alongside their endometriosis and finding their FODMAP issues and liberalizing and so on. And then sometimes we add on an evidence-based probiotic for the enhance their management of IBS. And when they respond more negatively to that and they've got some residual symptoms, I'm always like, oh my God, it could be SIBO. And then I refer on. So I was curious to hear if that was a good case. So yes, I'm glad that we're on the same page with that, because I always have thought that, suspected that, and have had that as a little red flag in my clients as well. My next question is SIBO chronic? Is SIBO forever? We talked a little bit about like relapse and remission kind of patterns, or is it kind of like a short-term stint of management with, you know, supportive diet, the antibiotic treatment with the gastroenterologist or the doctor, and then you eradicate the overgrowth, and then it's kind of you go into this kind of maintenance mode of just trying to deal with whatever the underlying cause is and hope that the symptoms don't return?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail there on the head, is that there's remission and there's treatment and then there's does it go away? In simple cases, in straightforward cases, you know, you do the treatment, bacteria goes away, you treat the reason it happened in the first place, and SIBO is gone. However, the relapse rate is quite high. So some people will need multiple rounds of treatment, some people it will come back later. And, you know, it kind of depends again on why it's happening in the first place, and is that something that can be treated? So if you have if you do have constipation, we can treat it. If you do have celiac disease, this can be treated. So if we, you know, address that issue of why it's happening, it's going to reduce the likelihood of relapse. But if you're missing something like the ileocecal valve, you know, unless you're getting a replacement for that, you know, it's highly likely that issues may happen again. So it depends on why it's happening in the first place, but yes, it's treatable. It's not necessarily forever. One thing that does kind of irk me in this space is people, which again, no fault of their own, but people will message me on Instagram and say, I have SIBO, in the sense they have had SIBO for 5 years, 10 years, or they got a diagnosis a long time ago. And to me, I wouldn't put this on my diagnosis plan of I currently have SIBO if you've been through treatment and your symptoms have resolved. You know, it's something that can be treated and can improve. So let's address that and then see, you know, next steps from there.
Yeah, it could fall into, I guess, either category, but perhaps people self-identify themselves as I have SIBO as a bit of a lifelong sticker on their forehead, so to speak, of this is my diagnosis, and they're self-identifying with that, which is interesting. I think that's a whole different conversation about how people self-identify with their diagnoses, because it's a huge thing that I see with the endo community as well. And I have lots of thoughts about it, which probably are on the side of slightly controversial. So we'll leave that for another time. But it's interesting how you share that. That's a good point.
And I mean, to add on to that, I have been to, you know, webinars and gastroenterologist talks on this topic that are really into the research. And I have also had a client that was on an ongoing dose of antibiotics because he had relapsing SIBO. So he had a specific dose as directed by his gastroenterologist that he would take every month, and that would clear up his symptoms every single month. And it would go on like that, because we couldn't, myself or the gastroenterologist who also specialized in the area, couldn't get down to, you know, preventing the relapse. And there are other cases I've heard from other gastroenterologists speak on this area that relapse can happen like that for some people. It's just constantly. So sometimes there is other protocols that are needed for that. And that, you know, that's okay. If that's what you need, if that's what your body needs at this stage, and, you know, in 5 years, we might have other options and that will change. But for me, I just always think about risk versus reward and quality of life. And you know, if that's what your body needs right now for you to function on a day-to-day basis, it's okay to need medication in scenarios.
Yeah, I guess people just would probably have trouble resolving that in their minds because we associate antibiotics with such a short-term use, like for like other things. So it would be hard to think about long-term management. And I think, I don't know, I think this generation potentially, like our generation, younger and maybe even slightly older than us, are very, I guess, trying to step away from medication for whatever reason. I don't know, there seems to be a lot of internalized shame perhaps about medication of any kind, not just about SIBO, but the pill or mental health meds or all these kinds of things. I think there's so much work to be done in destigmatizing the need for medication to improve your day-to-day life, your quality of life and all of that stuff. There's nothing wrong with it. That's why modern medicine exists, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I think personally it's something that I do like to talk about. Like sometimes you need medication, whether that's for mental health, whether that's a laxative for constipation, whether that's a back to this for SIBO. You know, I'm a dietitian. I do work from a holistic angle. I do help with my clients for diet and lifestyle and everything. But just because you're holistic doesn't mean that, you know, you have to be, if that's not working and medication works and that's what you need right now and it improves your thing and it helps you to eat more food in the diet, like it's okay. It's okay. And I also completely respect if you don't want to do medication, you want to try everything else first. Like I do try everything else first and then we go down these routes. Like it's not like you are diagnosed with SIBO and they're like, here, take an antibiotic for the rest of your life. You know, we try everything else first and then it's your decision of okay, well, this is what we're left with at this stage. What would you like to do and what works for you?
Yeah, and fingers crossed more research catches up in the meantime and to hopefully give you some more options as well, which hopefully they'll continue to work on. I know we touched on this a little bit earlier, but teasing out the differences between IBS and SIBO, we talked a little bit about probiotics and maybe that worsening symptoms, but there's no perfect separation, is there, when you're just looking at it face value on the symptoms, or what do you look for?
Yeah, I don't think there is any like, okay, you've got this symptom, that means this is SIBO, that means you have IBS. The symptoms can overlap hugely. Personally, in practice, like we spoke about, I look at what symptoms are improving, what symptoms are not responding to our treatment options. I look at that the level of bloat and the description of the bloating that people experience. There are some other bigger symptoms that can happen that are not directly IBS. So things like reflux, specific vitamin deficiencies. So with SIBO, there is sometimes some bile acid malabsorption going on. And in severe cases, there's then a malabsorption of our fat-soluble vitamins, so particularly A, D, and E. So if these are malabsorbing or if you have low levels of some of these vitamins, that can also be a bit of a red flag because it's not necessarily a symptom of IBS. So, you know, there's different things that your medical team can look for. But at the end of the day, you know, you can do the breath test, you can do the treatment, and that's can help direct it as well.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that because I can imagine there's probably a lot of people thinking, maybe my IBS might also be SIBO or might just be SIBO instead. What are some of those most common mistakes that you see people making when it comes to SIBO, whether it be diagnosis or management? What's that common trap that you see people fall into?
Yeah, I think there would be a couple that come under this category. One would be what you just mentioned then. And I think that with when we experience gut issues, it's really easy to hyperfixate on them and to start diagnosing yourself with all of the different medical conditions. And I have also fallen trapped to this, you know, when you hear about something like, well, that sounds like me, maybe it's this, and you end up in this rabbit hole of Googling it on Facebook groups, on Instagram, like learning more and more about it and convincing yourself that you have that. And, you know, I haven't gone into details what this means, but like when I say that we do other strategies first, some of these need to be done first. So we need to clear the constipation first. If you're constipated, you're probably going to be bloated. And just saying, I'm really bloated, I probably have SIBO, but if you have constipation, you know, let's deal with that first. Or if you are not sleeping and if you are not moving your body throughout the day, if you're super stressed, you know, all of these things we want to address first because they could be the reason. Or if you haven't even been to the doctor to have baseline medical testing done, like ruling out celiac disease. So all of these things, I think, it's really easy when you hear about a new condition or you are struggling with symptoms that you hyperfixate on it or, you know, go a little bit crazy thinking about it. So just really taking that step back and doing the foundations first, getting the medical test done first, and then linking up with a dietitian with experience in the area is what I would recommend. Another really common mistake, I think, which is more so, I think, the different people in this area, the other health practitioners that are promoting these kind of things, is the over-restrictive dieting. So really cutting out really significant amounts of foods out of the diet, following it for so long, maybe you do see some improvement and then you're too scared to go back, or you're just doing what you're told. But over-restrictive dieting is a huge red flag if someone's promoting that. And if it's not working for you, if it's too hard to follow, or you're finding it's creating more fear of food, also taking a step back from that. Another big mistake I see people making is along the supplement regime. So supplement regimes, sometimes, again, people are prescribed these expensive, you know, really large range of supplements that aren't evidence-based. So if someone is trying to push a bunch of supplements on you, I would be taking a step back and getting a second opinion, because it's not where the evidence is. So restrictive dieting, excessive amounts of supplements, and, you know, covering the foundations first are probably the biggest three mistakes happening in this area that I see.
Awesome. Well, not awesome for the mistakes, but awesome for pointing them out. What would be the first step for someone to take if they're struggling with their gut symptoms, whether they suspect it may be SIBO or IBS, or maybe they've been thinking about it and they haven't really stepped into it yet? They're a bit nervous about what it might involve. I know for me, a lot of people delay reaching out, and I think this would be similar for many dietitians, but especially with endo and gut health stuff, is the fear of being told that you can't eat a lot of foods. And that's a very intense fear, which really feeds into the procrastination of reaching out and getting help, because you feel like that's the only thing that's going to be necessary to get you where you want to go. So I guess, what would you say to someone who's perhaps a little bit procrastinating, but knows that they need to get help, they need to take that first step? What would you say to them?
Alongside that fear of food, I think another big barrier is people sometimes think their symptoms aren't bad enough. So first thing I would say, if you have mild symptoms, moderate symptoms, or severe symptoms, you know, no matter what scale they are, like, you deserve to feel better and you deserve to get help. So don't think just because I'm not bedridden or whatever it is, like, I'm not going to get help. Like, you still deserve help. There's lots of options for improving symptoms that don't involve restrictive dieting, which is something that I'm trying to promote more of, because I think there's this big misconception. So I have clients that purely we work together for months on end, and all we're focusing on is improving symptoms, adding things to the diet. We don't even touch cutting foods out, because it's not the only thing that you need to do. So know that it's not just about cutting foods. And if that is something you're worried about, reach out and say that. Say, you know, I do worry about my relationship with food. I don't want to cut foods out. And I will not cut foods out of your diet if you say that to me. If you are, and again, I'll figure that out as well in the first assessment. If there's some red flags there, and I'll say, you know, I don't think it's suitable. I actually think your symptoms are coming because of the stress or because of this. Like, let's work on that first. So just know that's not the only thing. In terms of, like, first steps, if you haven't seen your doctor yet, seeing your doctor is the first step. At a minimum, I want a blood test to rule out celiac disease. The biggest thing with that test is that don't cut gluten out of your diet before you see a doctor. So don't ever cut gluten out of your diet unless been instructed to by your dietitian, or you've been diagnosed with celiac disease. But the gluten needs to be in the diet for that test to be accurate. So see your doctor, reach out to a dietitian that's experienced in this area. It is a specialized field, so not every dietitian is going to be that helpful with it, but there is a lot of great ones in this space, whether that is myself or staff or someone else. You know, there is a lot of options out there.
Yeah, I think for people who are generally listening to this episode, perhaps some of your followers and so on, who are just navigating gut health, maybe plus or minus other concerns, definitely a gastroenterology, gut health kind of focused dietitian is your play. For people that are extremely symptomatic of endometriosis, or the endometriosis nutritional management hasn't been done, definitely see someone who can understand both. And, like, for my clients that come to me with endo and IBS, and, like, for the team as well, we manage the endo, we manage the IBS, but then once we've run out of our strategies and we're still symptomatic, that's kind of when we get to the point of then referring on to another practitioner if we suspect it's SIBO, or we're referring them back to their gastro or their gynae, potentially more surgery. It becomes a little bit more there's more pathways when you add in endometriosis on top, because you've also got another chronic condition that will mimic a lot of these symptoms that we've already discussed. And the causes can be similar, but they can also be different. So one of the most frequent questions I get from my endo clients is, Steph, how do I know this bloat is endo, and how do I know this bloat is my IBS? And I'm like, I can't tell you that. Like, I don't live in your body, so I can't know that. And in fact, I've experienced both and I don't know either. So there isn't a perfect explanation for each symptom that was going to neatly fall into its box. And so we have to be okay with the boxes all kind of melting together and navigating you through it. And ideally, identification and diagnosis is so important, but at the end of the day, you just want to feel better. So whatever it is that helps you feel better, let's just focus on that, is usually how I end up. I don't know how I ended up there, but we did. But thank you. Doctor, first step, don't cut the gluten. Endo people, please don't cut out gluten before you get tested for celiac disease. I've talked about it many a time, but your risk of autoimmune disease is significantly higher with endometriosis, not just celiac disease, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, lupus, Hashimoto's, thyroiditis, all autoimmune conditions that we are seeing higher prevalence rates of. So please do not eliminate gluten from your diet. If you really struggle with gluten digestively, that doesn't necessarily mean it's celiac disease and you should just assume that it's celiac disease. Like, proper testing is so important. So if you're struggling with that, definitely reach out to your doctor and your dietitian.
Yeah, definitely. And what I'll also just add on to that, particularly I know in the IBS space, and I'm sure it's similar with endo, is people often feel dismissed by their doctors in this space. It's not always taken seriously, or you feel like you're palmed off. And if that happens, seek a second opinion. Don't give up on it altogether. And particularly with SIBO, a lot of what I find is a lot of just general GPs aren't that around SIBO or don't really know that much about it. So that's when I go to a gastroenterologist, because most of the time gastroenterologists are more up to date with SIBO information and more willing to treat it. At the moment, I've been referring a lot of people to Monash Hospital. The gastroenterologists there I find are really, really great around SIBO. So if you're feeling stuck, call them, talk to reception and get an appointment with one of their gastros. And they're quite open about talking about SIBO, treating SIBO. So if that's the pathway that you're up to, don't give up if your doctor is kind of dismissing it. Just seek a second opinion or a third opinion.
Yeah, that's a great share. Thank you for sharing that with everybody, because I learned something new today too. So thank you. Crystal, where can people find out more about you and the work that you do, the incredible work that you do?
Yeah, so the easiest way is through Instagram. So I'm very noisy on Instagram. I post quite regularly and I'm here talking about these things all the time and giving away lots and lots of tips of how you can get started, how you can feel better. So my Instagram is at IBS FODMAP Dietitian. Send me a message if you want to have a chat, if any of this resonated with you, if you have any questions for me, or simply just follow along, and I would love to help you.
Thanks, Crystal. You've been a legend. What a wealth of knowledge you are on this space. And I really appreciate you and your time, because SIBO is something that I've always been like, ooh, what is this? Because I felt like for a long time, perhaps the traditional or conventional medicine world didn't really acknowledge it that much. And it kind of bordered on the woo-woo side. And so I was always a little bit skeptical to come too close to it, but I definitely feel as though conversation with you today has taught me a lot and made me feel a little bit more confident and comfortable with referring people to the right practitioners to help them with their next steps of their journey if we think they could have SIBO. So thank you so much, and yes, please go follow Crystal on Instagram. I know I've said it three times, but please do. It's an incredible page, so please go follow. All right, everyone, thank you so much for tuning into another episode of Fertility Friendly Food. I hope you enjoyed that episode with the incredible Crystal about SIBO and giving you a bit of an insight into what it's all about and my commentary in regards to its relevance in endometriosis. So don't forget to hit follow on whatever podcast streaming app you are currently using. Leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This is the very best way that you can say thank you for this free, valuable content direct to your ear holes. Don't forget to come and follow us on Instagram at @_dietologist and at @endo.dietitian. They're always linked in the show notes for you. And if you're still listening to this and you haven't gotten your ticket yet for Nourishing Your Gut with Endo Masterclass, then what are you waiting for? It will be on tonight, March 23rd, 2023, 7 p.m. Sydney time. Can't wait to see you there and help transform your tum into something a little happier. Hello, regular poops, less bloating, and more of the good stuff in life, less time in the toilet. Am I right? Can't wait to see you there. Until next time, everyone. Bye. Fertility Friendly Food, the podcast, acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connections to lands, waters and community. We pay our respects to First Nation cultures and to the elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all First Nations people tuning in today. This podcast is recorded on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation.